8:09 now. Good morning. In the studio with me, Kathy Nonell with State Parks. Good morning.
Good morning. So the big event this month is Military Appreciation Day, which is on August 13th. Military, get in free to all state parks. And then also make sure you make your reservations today or soon for Labor Day weekend, and don't wait till the last minute because it will fill up. Over at Deer Creek, they are open, and they are hosting a paddle fest on August 13th for Military Appreciation Day from 11 to 3. Try out kayaks, paddle boards, and paddle boats free at Rainbow Bay. At Wasatch Mountain State Park, all campgrounds, group areas, cabins, and roads are open. Golf courses are in great shape. Soldier Hollow is offering twilight rates. At 2 p.m., it's $38, and at 4 p.m., it's $20 for 18 holes. Upcoming activities include historic Huber Grove tours on August 7th and 13th, August 10th at 8:30 a.m., hike with the Friends of Wasatch to Shadow Lake in Guardsman's Pass. Trail Improvement Day is on August 13th from 9 to 1 at Dutch Hollow. The second annual Military Appreciation Day is August 13th also. We have a variety of activities planned. Golf courses are offering $38 all day for golf and 50% off breakfast and lunch for military. On September 8th, it's the Hit and Giggle, affectionately called the Hit and Piddle this year, because we are having a fundraiser for a new outside CXT restroom at the Visitor Center. Go to friendsofwasatch.org for more information and to register. It's $60 to play golf and dinner, and you don't have to know how to play golf to play in this tournament. Upcoming events for Labor Day weekend is a star party to be announced on Friday, September 2nd, Birds of Prey program on September 3rd at 7 p.m., and a geology hike on September 4th starting at 9 a.m. at the Visitor Center. We are working on a trail ambassador program called the Dirt Patrol. Trail volunteers will be on the lookout for people who are not obeying the rules or lost or hurt. If anyone is interested, they should contact the park for more information, and volunteers will receive park benefits. At Jordanelle State Park, all campgrounds and day use areas are open. The Aqua Zone is very popular. Go to jordanellerentals.com or aquaxzone.com for information and reservations. Day use fee at Jordanelle is $10 for a car during the week and $15 per car on the weekends. If you are camping at Jordanelle on Friday through Sunday, you can sign up for a personalized interpretive program before 6 p.m. at the Murdoch Camp Services. There is one more free boating clinic on August 4th. You'll get 2 hours of instruction. Call the park to sign up for that. Jordanelle is hosting a star party on August 5th at 9 p.m. at the Beach House. And on August 13th, sign up for the 5K run in honor of veterans. They're also having a pancake breakfast that morning, and all proceeds go to the NAC for military programs. At Rockport State Park on August 6th, Rockport will be hosting its first car show by Cliff's Garage. There will be a car show at the marina from 9 to 11 a.m. and then a campground parade at 11 a.m. The cars will drive around all the campgrounds. For Military Appreciation Day on August 13th, they will have a pig roast that is free to military and $5 per plate for everyone else. They will have Birds of Prey showing at the marina at 6, and they will also have fireworks show at 9 p.m. On August 12th through the 14th, it's the annual Dam Jam at the Old Church and Riverside Campground. Admission is $5 per vehicle for the day, and camping at Riverside is $15 a night. Rockport has a beach designated just for Hobie Cats, and they are in the process of putting a campground in that area. The water temperature at Rockport is about 75 degrees.
Okay. Kathy, we'll see you next month.
Okay.
Kathy Donnell, KPCW News Time now, 8:13 still to come. We'll be talking with Julie Eihausen and Molly Miller with Park City Schools. It's 8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Board of Education met on Tuesday to review a number of data-driven programs as well as the future of PC caps. In the studio with details, I have school board member Julie Eihausen. She's joined by communications specialist Molly Miller. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So let's start with SAGE testing. The school board voted to do away with state testing for high school students, saying that between the ACT and the AP test, the district, what, has all of the data it really needs?
Well, actually, the testing benchmark system that we use is Galileo, and it actually provides the information that we can drill down into exactly what standard a kid is missing. So it isn't just, oh, they're having an issue with English language arts, they're having an issue in spelling, or they're having an issue in a particular standard. And Galileo gives us all of the information, the same kind of information that SAGE gives us, but it's a deeper test, I guess, as far as measuring the growth. So SAGE was just really a duplication for us, and our high school kids are definitely taking a lot of tests between, you know, the ACT for every junior, their AP tests, and Galileo gives us the information we need. So we determined to get rid of a very lengthy test.
Okay, and that, again, is just for the high school students. It remains in place for the elementary and
it is, but any parent can opt their child out of the SAGE testing, and every child in the district is getting the Galileo test. So we are getting the information. So if you as a parent feel that you don't want them to go or have the SAGE testing, you're more than welcome to opt out.
So I was thinking that SAGE was mandated by the state, but Galileo then...
Galileo
replaces
is
that in terms of the state's mind?
No, not so much with the state. Galileo is a benchmarking system that Park City School District has adopted because it gives us more information, similar information as SAGE. SAGE is actually used, we found out in a meeting last night, several smaller districts use SAGE in the same way we use Galileo, because it is something that they can get that's significantly cheaper. They're not paying for a separate system. But we really like the information that the Galileo gives us. It's just a much more healthier information.
So can this then be used, because the state uses SAGE to give all individual schools a grade as well as the district a grade. So does Galileo do that for us?
Well, Galileo could do that for us, but the state has not recognized that as their testing mechanism. So we currently, this last year, we had 50% of our high school students opt out. So our grading or results regarding the SAGE test from the state, they're going to really be invalid because we only have 50% of our students that actually tested. So our grade of an A is most likely going to go down because we don't have the SAGE data, and that is a component. Now, the state is looking at if they're going to keep SAGE, if they're going to still, quote-unquote, mandate it, which you can't really mandate it when you're offering an opt-out. So we'll wait and see. The State Board of Education is looking at this.
Yeah, and so what we saw here in Park City is that many of the kids taking all of the other AP tests or ACT or whatever, opting out, and so tending to then downgrade the school score. So was that a concern of why it's like, well, let's just do away with it if it's not accurate anyway?
It isn't so much the score that the kids received who actually took the test. It's more that when you only test 50% of the population, whether they're high scoring or low scoring, it invalidates the test.
So how do Park City Schools then get measured? On an apples to apples comparison with other Utah schools.
That is a question that I think our state legislature needs to probably answer. Because, again, when you mandate a test that you're going to use for grading a school, when the test is actually supposed to be showing areas for improvement, where you need to focus your instruction, it kind of negates the reason for you doing a growth test. And so when you against quote-unquote mandate it, but then you allow people to opt out, It's a state legislature issue.
Yeah. So now that the state has provided funding for all 11th graders to take ACT, will we see that as maybe a measure?
The ACT test, this is the way that I like to explain it, because this whole formative and whatever, I get those mixed up. Sorry, school board member, but I still get mixed up. Basically, an ACT is an autopsy test. It's after everything's done, what has happened. The SAGE, the Galileo, those are growth tests. Those are tests to see what standard are we trying to hit. So they are not really apples to apples. The ACT, you really can't use that to grade a school. Now, whether or not that's something the legislature decides to do, we don't really have any control over that.
So it looks like we saw some data that's showing college readiness went down 5 points from 46% in 2015 to 41% this year. So was that due to the requirement that all 11th graders take in the ACT?
I don't know that I would tie it to that, because every batch or every group of 11th graders are different. And so, you know, unless we see a real steady trend of that being an issue, it's not something that raised a red flag for me.
So now do teachers in the high school start spending time prepping for ACT tests?
I would hope not.
Okay. Let's move on to PC CAPS. This year's budget for the program, about $175,000, and we have 65 students enrolled for the fall. So at what point does the district decide it's not worth the resources for such a small number of students participating?
Well, I'm not exactly sure where you got the 175, because since the PC CAPS has been absorbed back into the high school, there are people who are assigned to PC CAPS who have multiple other responsibilities. So their budget isn't separated out like it used to be. And as far as that program is also undergoing a restructure, we do know that we need to attract more students into the program. And we're not sure, is it because it takes up two class periods? Is that why, you know, kids who are juniors and seniors who have a relatively tight schedule, is that why they're not taking it? Is there something that we can do about that? Is it the offerings? You know, what exactly is it? And so they are looking at a restructure, and we will be closely following this program. And typically the high school, if you have a new class, it has about 3 years to get to, you know, an enrollment number of 23 to 25 students in a class, in a section or whatever. So we're going to be watching PC CAPS because it should have grown, because it's a great program. So we're just hoping that as we watch it with this restructure and with it now is under the leadership of the high school principal. It is not a separate standalone program any longer. So the integrating with CTE, we're hoping, increases enrollment.
Yeah, so what about Principal Bob O'Connor's recommendation that we hire a business development specialist to really get this program going?
I do think we need to have someone in outreach to our business. I don't know how much of the PC CAPS board can be utilized for that, because they are all very experienced business people. You know, Bob has got his budget for what he has as far as staff, and wherever he decides to allocate that, that certainly is his option.
Yeah. I mean, I guess word on the street is what I'm hearing is that unless kids have a project that they really love, they're just not having a good time in it, and so they're looking for something else that motivates them. I mean, so do we need to start over here?
Well, which is why we need them to have a project that they really love. I mean, my daughter did, you know, EMT and the CNA, and she was very, very interested in that. But that isn't a quote unquote PC CAPS class. But in actuality, it is a PC CAPS class, because you're doing your real world working when you're going and doing clinicals or what have you. So I think just to restructure the whole thing, make sure that each CTE class, what I'd like to see is for each CTE class to have a project at the end, and that just to be an expectation that that is what happens, and it's all PC CAPS, not just, you know, engineering or business.
Yeah. So at what point does the board decide that we do away with the PC CAPS and then just go for CTE classes?
PC CAPS and CTE have already been folded in together. So I don't foresee getting rid of any kind of a PC CAPS. That's really the wave of the future as far as project learning. It may be called something different. I doubt it, because CAPS is kind of a nationwide acronym. But I think we're just going to have to wait and see how it goes.
Do they still then use the library area as the...
Currently they are, but the design team has been meeting, and we have not been presented yet with their options. They are going to present us with at least three options for expanding the high school. And I don't know how much of that, or if any of that, would include revamping of the PC CAPS area. The library area is not large enough if we are going to have all of our CTE classes have a project. So that's the design team's work.
Well, on Tuesday, the school board voted 3-2 to open the high school design meetings to the public. You were one of the nay votes, though, Julie. How come?
I am of the mindset that there are 20 people that are working on this committee. If anyone is interested and wants to provide input, there are community members with their information, contact information is available. I think that this committee needs to be focused on doing their work. They have a lot of things they need to discuss and things they need to move forward with. And if the staff is more concerned with making sure, oh, did we post an agenda? Oh, did we post this? We've changed the time of the meeting. Have we made sure everybody knows? That just logistically, to me, puts more of a burden. And there are minutes available. They have been recording the meetings. I just don't see the reason for everything to be open. Not that I'm not open to open, but it comes to the point of, do we open up every staff meeting? Do we open up every BLT meeting? Do we open up every RTI meeting? Do we open up, you know, Todd's meetings of how he's going to structure the accounts payable, the accounts receivable? I mean, it gets to the point where, not that I don't want community involved, because I absolutely do, but the school district has to be able to function in a way that they can function.
Still, as you saw with the bond campaign, though, this is very important. This isn't one of the RTE or any, some of those other maybe meetings that people aren't interested. We know people are interested in that. And I think that was one of the criticisms that we heard last year, was that people didn't know about it. And, well,
every single master planning meeting before the bond, prior to the bond, was open to the public. Every single one. So that whole, that it wasn't open, that we weren't available, that was a perception that was, in my mind, incorrect, because it was completely open. So opening them up again, I'm not really sure how that diffuses the argument that we're not being open.
We just talked a lot about during the campaign, as you recall, you know, about how the public, they were really late to the party. I mean, you guys had been meeting for a year already, and it was like it took people a year to even figure out that there was a master planning committee. So again, I mean, I just, if you really want to be open and, you know, get the public on board for what needs to happen at the high school, you would think that this would be, yes, please come, be quiet, but please come.
Again, that's what we did last year. And you know, it's a 3-2 vote, so the meetings are open, so yep. Please come.
Okay. Now, aren't all of these ad hoc meetings open to the public then?
It depends. It depends on whatever the committee is, and it depends on the public interest. To be honest with you, the curriculum committee was also another one that was requested for that to be open. That actually is a district committee, an interfunction. You know, curriculum is not... it's an operation of the district. So that actually is a district committee. So when they get to the point where they're talking about facilities, then yes, there will be a design team that includes the public for the 5, 6, 7, 8 placement of wherever we're going to put that 5, 6 school.
All right. There was a ton of information on test results and student progress presented Tuesday. If someone has insomnia issues, how do they get their hands on this information?
As far as I know, that information is going to be made available to the parents during... Go ahead.
Yes, during meetings, during back-to-school nights, and there will also be a mental health awareness and student safety night. We're not sure the exact date of that, but that will be forthcoming. Also, that entire presentation certainly is available online right now, and it's linked on Board Docs, which is a public access, for the public to access that. But we will certainly be disseminating that information.
Okay. So we're going to do another mental health night, even though we had like 4 people show up at the last one.
That's correct. So I think we're kind of putting this as a back-to-school event. We're working with the counselors because there is such a need for more attention in the mental health arena. We've seen an increase in that need, and we're paying attention to that, and we're working together. Dr. Conley is also going to have a viewing of the movie Resilience in October, which ties into that as well. But certainly the district is really focused on that. We want our kids to be happy and healthy.
All right. Let's see, in terms of hiring, how many teachers are we welcoming to the district?
This year, we are hiring 12 additional teachers. But in the past 3 years, I think it's over 30, what is it,
34? 34.
Excuse me. We have the focus that the superintendent and this board is looking at is we are looking at lowering class sizes, excuse me, hiring licensed instructors. And I've said this before, you know, if I have an option of hiring 2 aides versus 1 licensed teacher, I'm always going to go with the licensed teacher and lowering the class sizes. So for next year, our kindergarten classes are capped at 20. They have a teacher and they have a full-time aide in the classroom, a trained qualified aide. And then all of our classes from first grade to fifth grade, we have one class that is at 25, and that's a DLI class. DLI is capped at 25. Every other class is below that. We have classes ranging from 11 to 23 for the vast majority of our elementary grades. And by moving some money out of administration and putting that into the classroom, that's what gave us the opportunity to lower those class sizes so significantly. And I have to tell you, after 15 years of lobbying for lower class sizes, I'm very happy with the numbers.
So that was something at the meeting where you approved, the board approved the severance agreement with Tom Van Gorder. You seem very torn about that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's difficult to wrap your head around what you can define as an investment in something that maybe doesn't have a tangible outcome. However, I do agree with some of my fellow board members and also with Dr. Conley in that she needs to be building a team and she needs to be moving forward and she needs to have everyone on board, on the same page, and moving forward. And while that does seem like it's a large dollar amount, if you take a look at the compensation that had already been received, it's very similar. And it also, I do want to point out that our balanced sustainable budget includes that particular dollar amount that's being paid out. We are not going in the hole or borrowing or whatever. We have moved money around, shifted some different positions around to be able to cover that.
And the job duties of the Director of Student Services just get panned out to other staff?
The entire district office is being restructured. And so we are looking forward to seeing an organizational chart when Dr. Connolly is all done as far as reassigning or reallocating. We're not sure exactly what that's going to look like, but all of the duties that the district office, or actually all of the district administration does, all of that is being restructured. And that actually has been something that the public has been calling for a while also.
All right. So do you have more positions to fill then before start of school?
We do have about 5 openings right now. You can find them at pcschools.us under jobs. We have like a science teacher, a theater teacher, a business teacher. I know they were just doing interviews for an English teacher over at Treasure Mountain. The thing we really need, though, are substitute teachers. So we lost about 10 subs last year because we hired them full time. They were so good. So we need to build that bench again. Again, that application is available on pcschools.us.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Starting free all-day kindergarten this fall, which is an amazing initiative. And also you'll be hearing a lot more in the coming weeks about the new Child Nutrition Health Initiative. It's called 15 to Clean. We're getting rid of 15 potentially harmful ingredients and additives for school menus. It's an amazing program, and you'll be hearing a lot more soon.
All right, Julie Eihausen, Molly Miller, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
News time now, 8:33. Still to come, we'll be talking with State Representative Mel Brown. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Lindsay with Recycle Utah. Do you know how much water is needed to produce the food you eat? On average, it takes 600 gallons of water to produce a single beef hamburger. Compare that to the 80 gallons of water needed to produce a veggie burger. Consider how diet choices affect our environment.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. And we support KPCW.
It's 8:34. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we've reported, after a recount, longtime Summit County Representative Mel Brown will not go on to November's election. That after losing the primary election to newcomer Logan Wild by just 9 votes. Mel Brown joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Mel.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. This was Summit County's first venture with mail-in voting. So given the outcome, what do you think about it all?
Well, I guess it's a new experience. If I had my choice, I would not do mail-in voting. But, times change and things change. I think probably, in my view, the process has some bugs in it that need to be worked out. And obviously, I think that's probably what happened in this case, it being such a close election.
Yeah, let's talk. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I mean, why do you think you lost the race? Did you not campaign hard enough? Did you think it was a slam dunk? Did you underestimate the support for Logan Wilde, or does it like many things do come down to money?
Well, no. I think there's a combination of things. We campaigned really hard. Probably harder than we have in a lot of cases, because I've only had two primary elections in my political career, and both of them have been very contentious and hard to deal with, so we expected that. But one of the problems, of course, is always voter turnout. Primary elections come at the time of year when people are just not thinking about politics. They're busy with vacation, school's out, kids are not home, routines are broken, and that's the case. And so if you can focus hard on a particular constituency, which I think he did in his own county, then sometimes you can overcome the odds. And in this case, we have five counties. I won four of the five, and he won one. But he won his big enough to counter the other four.
Okay. So you don't think it has anything to do with kind of the throw the bums out mentality here?
Well, you know, there's always that. I don't think that that's ever an issue that in some people's minds, one day's enough.
Yeah.
In other people's minds, it's not. In other people's minds, they think experience and knowledge is an important thing. So it's all a matter of opinion. Everybody has an opinion about something, and if they exercise that opinion, that's what elections are about.
So we had 64 outstanding ballots from Morgan, Summit, Rich, and Duchesne counties, all with that June 28th postmark. The day of the election disqualified. So, I mean, what are your suggestions? How do we fix this so that that doesn't happen again? I mean, certainly we've heard the jokes about letting the post office be in charge here. But, I mean, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, I've spent hours and hours poring over this, not only with myself, but with other people who understand election laws. I've discussed it with the lieutenant governor's office, our county clerk. One of the problems, I don't think the law is quite as flawed as we think it is. I think what it is a lack of responsibility in carrying out the law. That's my opinion. Because if there would have been proper communication between our election officials and the postal system, I don't think this would have happened. Because what you have is a situation where we rely, I guess, on the general public to be informed and know and understand all of these things. But the average citizen, when they drop a mail or a letter or a ballot in the box on the day before election, which the law requires, they just assume that that's going to be all they need to do. And that's what the law says. It has to be postmarked. That's the issue, before election day. Well, in most of these rural communities, they have drop boxes that if you drop a box or a ballot in the mailbox after the post office are closed on the day before election, it's not going to get postmarked that day. But the average person doesn't know that. They think that they put it in that day, that's all they need. In fact, there was some social media come out from the elections office in the state on that day before the election, three different notices on social media that said, vote today, you've got to vote today, this is the day, all three of them. The only thing they didn't include in that was the issue that had to have a postmark today. And by then, people who come home from work, sit down, take five and say, oh, I got to get my ballot in, so they fill it out, run it to the post office, and by then it's too late. Because the post office is closed, they drop it in the box, and that mail's gathered up, sent to Salt Lake, the processing center, and postmarked the next day. And there, in fact, becomes the problem. I think the communication between our election officials and the Postal Service is the main problem, because it says it has to be postmarked before Election Day, and then there's an or, clearly marked by the postal system that they had received that ballot that day. Well, the problem is, how does the Postal Service and how does anybody know how to communicate that and carry that out under the existing system? Because the postal workers have gone home. It's still the day before election, and people are dropping mail in the box thinking that their ballot's going to be valid. And that's the hardest part for me. I've been through this process long enough and enough times to know that there's winners and losers, and some win and some lose. I recognize the fact that could happen, and I'm not sour grapes about that. All I'm concerned about is there's a lot of people. It's a way more than 60-some, Leslie. What it is, there's 60-some that are in District 53 Republicans only, but there's in Summit County alone, if you count the unaffiliated and the independents who had to vote in school board elections and other elections, there's close to 165. And then you add those with all the other counties, there's probably somewhere around 300 total voters who've been disenfranchised by that particular process.
Let's talk a little bit about your experiment in mail-in. As you mailed some certified letters from where? Colville?
No, I didn't mail certified letters. I just dropped letters. I mailed one from every post office in Summit County. I went to north to Hennifer, I went to Colville, I went to Echo, I went to Peoa, I went to Oakley, I went to Camas, Francis, and one in the main post office in Park City and one in Kimball's Junction. And I mailed them all the day before, or I mailed them all a certain day. I put just a note in each one, and I had a notary public notarize that was put in that envelope. Their notary stamp was on it. I just mailed it back to myself and started gathering them up, and every one of them was put in on a certain day, and every one of them were postmarked the next day.
And what time did you mail them that day?
That's my point. What difference does it make? If the law says I have to have it postmarked the day before, I'm assuming that whenever I put it in the mail the day before, it's going to be postmarked that day.
Yeah, but were the postal workers gone when you mailed them? I mean, was it after 5?
Some of them weren't.
Okay, interesting.
And so, anyway, it's not that issue as much as it is why wasn't there some communication? See, on tax day, we know that the general public knows that they have to have their taxes in by a certain day. And the Postal Service cooperates. They'll give you a postmark right up to 1 minute before midnight on tax day. They'll postmark it that day. The problem is, in this process, the communication didn't take place. And first of all, I don't know how the Postal Service could adjust to it anyway. So that, you know, how they can't keep people there all night to put posts in. But there should have been some kind of an indication, a box somewhere, a notice in the post office, whatever, saying if you're mailing your ballot after a certain hour, put it in this box so we can postmark it the day we receive it. But see, the communication there, I think the bureaucratic breakdown is the biggest problem. And I don't care how we change the law, it's still going to be that kind of a problem as to how you're going to solve it, because we're disenfranchising voters, and I don't like that.
Yeah, and I think I hear you saying, I mean, it's really, maybe the law doesn't need to be changed. What we need is an education campaign on mail-in voting.
Well, yeah, that or scrap mail-in voting. I've never been a fan of that. You know what I think we ought to do? I think we ought to declare Election Day a national holiday and expect people to go vote. People are always going to have their choice. Some will vote, some won't. That's their choice. But those who choose to exercise that right, and that should be able to do it without having to follow a script set of rules that has been traditionally different, that's been different than they've traditionally done throughout their life.
Well, you're going to have some time next year to follow that up with our congressmen. But in the meantime, do you now endorse Logan Wild for the District 53 spot?
Sure. He won the election. What choice have I got?
Are you finished with politics, or do we see you back in a couple of years?
Oh, you know, I'm old enough probably to quit.
Should Summit County residents...
I'm going to be involved some way, you know. You don't just walk away that many years of service without you being involved in the process. There's some issues I'm very concerned about and had a very deep interest in being involved with to see some conclusion. And so I think I'll be probably indirectly involved. I don't suppose you'll see me at the Capitol, but I'll be doing other things.
Now, should Summit County residents be concerned? We're losing a seasoned and somewhat moderate Republican for an unknown.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that the apathy in Summit County and their voters might have to pay a little price for that, because others don't understand our circumstances, our conditions, and our needs, we basically have turned over the political process to a minority county is what the issue is.
Word on the street is that Mr. Wild was backed by those who support charter schools. Should we be concerned that even more funding gets pulled from our traditional schools?
Oh, I think that's true. I don't know this directly. This is strictly a supposition on my part, but I think he was supported by that group. At least there's some indication. And we've got to make some hard decisions in education. We've got to decide whether our public system is going to continue and provide the mainstream education for our children, or if I've always supported education choice, Leslie. I believe in it, but I don't believe that the public can afford everybody's choice. That's my point. During my whole lifetime and yours, there's been choice in education. People often to send their children to parochial or private schools and so on. And I think that choice is fine. But we can't continue to support choice and fund it based on taxpayers' dollars, or the whole system's going to fail. We just can't afford it, especially in Utah with the tax base we have.
So is your representative seat basically over at this point, or you continue on through the rest of the year? I mean, I don't know how much business there is to conduct.
Yeah,
but
I don't fold my tent until the 1st of January.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to...
I'll be attending all my interim meetings and have input there and all the committee assignments I have until January, and then the gauntlet will be passed to someone else.
All right. Well, we'll catch up with you towards the end of the year for kind of a retrospective.
I'll be glad to chat with you again.
Okay. Mel, thanks for your time this morning. It's 8:50 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The Tour of Utah rides through Park City this weekend, meaning there will be rolling stops and a lot of traffic and parking impacts, especially on Sunday in the studio. What details on how we all deal with it? I have Transportation Manager Alfred Knotts along with Special Events Director Jenny Dearson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, let's see. Saturday, the Snow Basin to Snowbird Lake bikers are just riding through?
Yep. Bikers are just riding through Park City along the race course. We do expect impacts that day between 1 and 3 o'clock. Really, there's normal parking and transit operations that day. But again, between that 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock time period, we will have temporary rolling closures. Really, the estimate for the closure is generally about 20 minutes. Those closures will be affected on Kearns, Bonanza, Deer Valley Drive, and up Marsac prior to getting up to Guardsman's Pass, as they do head to Snowbird there. And I think it's also important to also mention on Saturday, there's also the Ultimate Challenge, which is a bike ride that follows the pro route. And they will also be coming through Park City. There is a water station at Treasure Mountain. And again, it's really rules of the road with that one. It's a ride with the Ultimate Challenge, not a race. And again, they follow those same roads. So Kearns and Bonanza, Deer Valley up to Marsac. So just expect that and watch for the cyclists that day as well.
Okay. So even though Kearns is closed now, at least two lanes of it closed due to the water main, that's really not going to affect this because they're going up Bonanza instead?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see. Then what do people do? Just have to pull over and sit for 20 minutes where they are? Is that how it works?
So we're really trying to get the word out so people can do what they can do to work around those closures and those time impacts. Again, it's kind of a broad range between 1 and 3, and we will watch the course as those roll forward. There is the tour tracker, so you can download that app if you want and take a look at that so you know when the race is coming through specifically. But really do just plan ahead. If you have somewhere you absolutely have to be between those time frames, plan ahead and know those impacts on Saturday.
Okay. And then in terms of, like, buses that do use those routes, what happens to them?
So what we do for those buses is we understand the route and the impacts, and we try to get the buses through in that area. They are our first priority, and we want to make sure people can get on those buses and get to where they need to be during the course. So we do try and get them through.
Okay, so special accommodations that are made for the transit?
Yeah, just to get them through. Of course, during the hard closure, that we can't get them anywhere, but again, they do have priority.
Okay, on Sunday we got a bigger mess, though, because we've got Main Street all closed and we've got really the race starting and ending here. So what happens then?
So on Sunday at about 3 o'clock in the morning, Main Street and Sweet Alley will close. Main Street and Sweet Alley are both part of the course. Again, that's all of Main Street and all of Sweet Alley. And that's we're also building the expo on Main Street. And then, of course, that's also part of the course. There is parking available at Park City High School. That is free parking with free direct transit to Main Street area to be here and to see the start of the race and also to see the finish of the race. And then we are going to also have Richardson Flats open. If you wish to meet up there and carpool, you can do that. You can also meet there and take your bike in on Poison Creek and the trail there to get in here to Main Street. And then we've also worked with Vail, and they will have the Cabriolet lot open. We will have regular transit to that lot. So that's the Canyons Village lot. So that's a 30-minute service out there. And parking here at China Bridge will be $10 cash, and you can do that as well.
So for those who have a China Bridge parking pass, that's no good?
So China Bridge parking pass, you can park in North Marsac and then also at the Gateway Center, which is over on Heber. And I think it's important to mention this year and years past, Park Avenue has been part of the race course, and it is not this year. So regular parking and traffic will happen on Park Avenue, and we believe and we hope that that'll help some of the traffic egress in that area as well.
All right. So what about the rolling stops then on Sunday?
So rolling stops on Sunday, the race is expected to start right around noon. We really highly recommend if you want to see the start of the race, you should be to the high school for parking by 11 o'clock to get to Main Street in time. And then we anticipate the roads will be back open around 1 o'clock. And the finish of the race, you should really be wherever you want to be at about 3 o'clock. The race should be back to Main Street around 3:30 or 4, and as soon as possible after the race course, we'll do what we can to reopen Main Street and Sweet Alley. That is anticipated right around 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock that night.
All right. So, Albert, how are we bumping up service then in terms of transit? I mean, do we have more drivers and buses on the road? Or
They will send trippers if there's extra people at the parking lots, like at the high school and so on. At the Cabriolet, it'll be regularly scheduled service, about 30 minutes. But if there's people waiting, then they will send extra buses. So we're really trying to get everything. I've been working a lot with Jenny and Tommy and Jason about trying to get everything really standardized here so everybody understands how these events operate, the locals and people that come to visit, that we have a standardized operation. So that's really what we're striving for with having Richardson Flat open just as a carpool lot, but hopefully next year we'll have it open as a true park and ride lot also. So working towards those standardizations, having transit-only lanes from Bonanza into town, and then again just having everybody trying to use alternative modes and to be able to be prepared to travel as you need to get there early. And if you need to take care of your own errands, to do those during certain times also.
All right. Main Street then reopens when?
Main Street should be reopened by 10 p.m. is what we're thinking. I do also want to mention, I forgot to mention, at the Galleria lot, there will be a free bike valet. So if you do want to ride your bike to the event, then you're welcome to do that, and you can park your bike there as well.
All right. And then, again, the expo will be on one side of Main Street, both sides, and people just walk up?
The expo will be on the east side, so that's on the post office side, and it'll be in between the dining decks there. So, and again, I think another good thing to remind people of is the start finish is all the way at the top of Main Street, kind of between Treasure Mountain Inn and the Wasatch Brew Pub. So the expo is kind of up on that portion of the street from Heber up, again, on the east side of the street there.
Okay, so good practice for the following weekend with Arts Festival, huh?
Exactly.
Yes.
It'll run pretty much similar.
Very similarly, yes.
Exactly.
Okay,
so,
anything else?
That's it. We're really just trying to get the word out and the timing and everything. So it's a little different event for the Tour of Utah with the rolling closures and so on. So just having everybody prepared that when these things do occur, that they're prepared and or traveled before or after.
All right, real quick, Alfred. Is Park City involved at all with Summit County's e-bike $500,000 grant?
Yes, we are.
Okay, and then so what are we going to see? What would we see here in town?
We're working on getting that done out at Kimball and then looking at Old Town also. And we're doing a feasibility study about where those locations would be.
And that's what we would see, kind of some bike stand with, like what we see in Salt Lake with those green bikes, right?
Yes.
And so you put in a credit card and pull out a bike.
Yeah, and that's what we're studying right now or analyzing is how we would do the actual maintenance, the storage, and the locations, and how the charging, meaning the charging of the customer would operate also. So it would be very similar to what's done down in Salt Lake with their green bike program.
Yeah. So is it always the bike has to be returned? I mean, does it have to be like a two-way, or can you just drop it off, get somewhere and drop it off there?
Those are the logistics we're kind of working out right now. It's a little different just because how they community is laid out, but we do anticipate that people would be able to go from point A to point B and drop a bike there, and then that concessionaire or vendor would be able to grab those bikes and be able to take them back to the stands that they need to. So that's part of the contract that we're working out.
All right. So you'll be doing that this winter then? And
we're actually doing a pilot over August through the county's doing a pilot out at the county fair also. So we're trying to get the vendor out here. We were trying to do something for Arts Fest, but it's probably not the most conducive area to have people riding around and trying these bikes out. But we do look to have something this fall and then something fully operational next year.
Okay. Hey, Alfred and Jenny, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:59.